Very much. Wow, this is a very fast-paced morning. First of all, I want to thank you very much for the very kind invitation and the opportunity to discuss the funding for MOFAS. This is an organization that was founded by my wife, so I'm kind of her surrogate, if you will, this morning. But it was a program, what she noticed as a juvenile court judge was the vast number of young people coming through our criminal justice system that had been impaired as a result of their mother drinking during pregnancy. Her estimate, it's a conservative estimate, is that roughly 20% of all those people in our correctional facilities are impaired by fetal alcohol. Now, the fundamental decision that any government has to make is whether or not we want to continue to pay for faulty outcomes or put more of our resources into the prevention. And the sad tragedy is that every time there's a budget crunch, it's the prevention side of the agenda that gets cut because we always feel compelled to pay for the faulty outcomes. Now, the faulty outcomes of incarceration vary, but you're not going to get them for less than $30,000 a year. I think in Hennepin County, when I left the governorship, I think the average was about $42,000 per year per person. And we all know that the outcomes of incarceration are not very favorable, and the rate of recidivism is enormously high. So it's a lose-lose proposition. The question then becomes, how do you take budgets and put more of it into prevention? Let's assume that my wife's estimate of roughly 50,000 children born every year impaired by fetal alcohol is reasonably accurate. We know now that nationally, one out of 100 people resides in an American prison. That's an enormous burden. But it's also a frightful embarrassment of a society that says we're the richest in the world, yet we can't put a penny into prevention. And all we keep doing is shouting for more and more people to go into the system. And the decision you've got to make this morning is, are you willing to shift the assets so that we can prevent the problem? Let's assume for the sake of discussion that we can prevent 10% of that 50,000 from ever getting into America's or Minnesota's correctional system. That's 5,000. That's potentially one facility per year that you're going to have to build if you don't put money into prevention. That's how expensive it is. We now have reached that stage in both American and local politics where, sadly, bad decisions tend to trump over good decisions. We spend more time as a nation discussing the politics of politics as opposed to the substance of politics. And far too much is focused on, oh, Lord, how do I get through the next election, as opposed to doing that which is right. This particular program started out roughly with $7 million when I left the office of governor. With the proposed cuts, it's now down to $1.2 million. That's well over 80%. If in the current budget this crisis is being met with an average of 4% cut, why then is one program singled out for a 30% cut? Particularly when it's on the prevention side. Part of the reason is it doesn't have a big constituency. But the truth is, you are its representatives. You're the ones who have to say that this problem is going to be reduced from 50 to 40 to 30, and you're going to have to commit the resources to it. And you're going to have to call organizations like MOFAS back in every 2 years and say, what kind of success have you met with? And what is it that we can do to partner with you so that we get the kinds of outcome that we as a society want? And what kind of long-term planning can we engage with you on so that we get those kinds of results? The truth is, MOFAS can no longer continue to stagger by being singled out for deeper and deeper reductions. I worked with a child several months ago asking the court to put this person into a training program. And the judge very wisely did so. That program was extraordinarily costly. But the outcomes for this child are probably pretty good. What had happened to this individual, as is so common with so many children afflicted with fetal alcohol, is that he truly did not understand logical consequences. He thought nothing, in this particular case, he was from St. Cloud. He thought nothing of going to school with his friends. One of his friends would say, oh, let's steal a car and go for a joyride. So he goes along for the joyride. He doesn't understand what the consequences are. And so he needs special training. He needs to manage and to learn to manage his problems. His parents have to be part of that. He's in a foster home. But all of this requires assistance. There's a program that will have to be cut that affects Minneapolis. Desperately needs it. The choice you have to make is one weighing priorities. And there's no way you can weigh priorities without coming up to the conclusion that we're going to fund those programs that prevents serious problems from developing. So I thank you, Madam Chairperson, and I thank members of the committee, and I'll be very happy to respond to any inquiries or any questions you may have.
Are there questions? Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I don't have a question. I just want to thank Governor Carlson. I've always been a huge fan of yours, and I want to thank you for the service that you've given to this state. And I want to thank you for really putting it all in perspective. And I think you're so right. We need a few more people like you around here. And I feel the same way you do, that we really, not all of us, but a lot of us here, look ahead to the next. How do we get through the next election? And it's unfortunate that we don't have in my mind, a long-range plan as far as education is concerned, as far as healthcare is concerned. It's just to the next election. And then when we get a new governor, that governor seems to have all the great ideas that'll fix education and fix healthcare. And then it's just something all new all over again. So I just want to thank you for your service. I was excited to see your name on the list. I saw number 9. I thought it was George Stephanopoulos. I was pretty excited about that. I'm a big fan of his, too, but I'm sorry, Doctor. I guess that it's not George Stephanopoulos. So, Governor Carlson, thank you for your service.
Well, Senator, you're very, very kind. And if I may just pick up on the second part of your very kind comments, and that has to do with how do you introduce long-term planning and thoughtfulness into a system that seems to operate hour by hour? If you were to ask most of us who have retired, which vote would we like to have back, be it Democrat or Republican, the one vote that seems to come up consistently is annual sessions. And part of the reason is the disappointment with how that reform had worked out. The expectation originally was that the second year of a session could be used to get away from the passing of bills and be more of a review session. We spun out program X. We're now going to review it. How's it doing, et cetera? That allows for long-term planning. The anticipation was that we would have a State Department of Planning, which would have all the studies done that the legislature and the governor wanted so that we could plan. You take a look very quickly at today's society. Today's paper has a large article on the crumbling, if you will, of higher education. We're literally hanging on by our fingernails on that one. Now, wouldn't it have been wise for us to have anticipated those kinds of problems and have some options, thoughtful options, put on the table to say, here's what we have to do. If we have a decreasing number of minorities being able to come through higher education, that's a problem. It's not a problem for them. It's a problem for all of us because we lose. If we have a low graduation rate, why? What can we do to encourage more people to complete? What kind of a burden does tuition put on the average student? In my day, the expectation was that a student could work during the summer, save enough money, and that would essentially pay the tuition bill. That's no longer the case, not just here, but literally all over America. Well, once that dynamic changes, that has impacts. Students find themselves going to school longer and longer. They get married, they have children, they drop out. There are all sorts of things that occur. My only point is, because it's the point that I think you raised, Senator, I think it's an absolute superb one. And that is, maybe the time has come for us to get into the business of taking a few days off from passing bills and start discussing some topics that transcend party lines. One is, how do we professionally put together a long-term budget? This nonsense of Band-Aids and Band-Aids and prayer does not work. And how do we get professional people and agree upon what a professional is into those areas that are so vital to our future? How do we get the planning function back into our own activities? And how do we, particularly as a Senate, become a more reflective body as opposed to becoming part of a bill-passing factory? And nationally, you see the same thing. You see a presidential race, forget about your partisan inclinations. But take a look at what we're not discussing. We're not just really discussing global warming. We're not really discussing the declining dollar, the rising deficits, and the impact that that has both short and long term on our ability to economically succeed. But rather, we're wrapped up in every little zing and zag that we can possibly get a hold of, and we have a media that's obsessed with the politics of politics. And so the greatest generation left us a legacy of substance, and we have now turned it into a chess game. Well, those are my philosophical comments for the morning. Thank you.
Governor, before you leave, you were here when we created the Health Care Access Fund. And the budget that's been presented to us diverts $398 million of that funding into the general fund to balance the budget. And I just wondered if you have any opinion on that.
Well, I have fairly strong opinions. First of all, I think any budget should reflect truthfulness. One is, inflation is a reality of life. If a school district has to budget for fuel costs, how in the world can we pass a law saying we're not responsible for the rise in the cost of fuel? Inflation is a reality of life. You can't have inflation in the spending side or in the revenue side of a budget, take it out of the spending side, and then say, look, what a wonderfully balanced budget we have. Of course you don't have a balanced budget. People like John Gunyu told all of us two and a half years ago that we'd be back in the same pickle we're in today. So that's not a surprise. It was planned. The second part is this borrowing. Well, it's not borrowing when you take money with no intent to pay it back. Now, many people believe the government should be more like a business. Well, if I go to a bank and want to borrow some money, I have to lay out a plan on how I intend to pay it back. To the best of my knowledge, there hasn't been the slightest effort to pay back the $1 billion that was taken from the tobacco fund and the implications that that has on health care. To the best of my knowledge, there isn't any language being suggested on how the Health Care Access Fund is going to be, quote, paid back. The truth is, the way we're paying it back is by making sure that fewer and fewer people, particularly children, have access to health care. It's another way to slice, if you will, at the prevention side of the agenda. That's wrong. So if I were in your shoes from a budgetary perspective, be you Democrat or Republican, I would bring in John Gunyu and Jay Kudrowski, a Democrat and Republican, and say, hey, people, help us. What can we do to put together a professional budget, a truthful budget, and one, by the way, that will be in balance 2 years from now and takes into consideration all the growth and costs and revenues, anticipated over the next 6 years.
Thank you, Governor. Other questions? Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Governor Carlson, thank you. Thank you for your comments today. And as I was sitting here listening to you speak, I couldn't help, when I think about Governor Carlson and I think about honesty and transparency in that budgeting process, and what we heard you talk about today, Governor, was in budgeting your plan. And I think what Governor Carlson is saying to us as leaders in the state of Minnesota right now is that we need to take the time to have a thoughtful discussion on what our priorities are and what the plan should be, and then we need to put forth the budget that reflects that plan. So thank you very much, Governor Carlson.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Thank you again.
It's a delight. I wish you the very best. Thank you.
Sam Walseth.
Madam Chair, members, I want to thank the governor for giving me my warm-up act today. I promise to fall short of that. I do want to echo a lot of his comments, though, about prevention, because that's what I want to talk to you about this morning. And Madam Chair, I'll be brief. My name is Sam Walseth. I represent an organization called the Sustainable Resources Center. And the Sustainable Resources Center is a nonprofit organization here in Minnesota that is dedicated to ending childhood lead poisoning. And to do that, we need to employ prevention tactics in Minnesota. And the Sustainable Resources Center is also the designated ClearCorps site here in Minnesota. ClearCorps stands for Community Lead Education and Reduction Corps, and it's an AmeriCorps-funded program. And the state dollars that you provide each year help the Sustainable Resources Center draw down a dollar-for-dollar federal match that support those lead poisoning prevention activities here in Minnesota. And also, as you'll see in a moment, these funds are also helping to leverage HUD dollars in Hennepin County as well. First of all, Madam Chair, members, thank you for the investment you made in the last budget bill for these prevention efforts. We did get an increase in funding over the previous several bienniums, and those dollars have been put to great use, and including supporting many important prevention activities like blood lead screenings for children under the age of 6 across Minnesota, in-home education for families, lead hazard controls through cleaning, paint stabilization, and window replacements. In fact, in 2007, the Sustainable Resources Center and the ClearCorps activities were able to accomplish the following objectives. 102 screenings and education events were held in 14 counties across Minnesota. 195 in-home visits took place with families. 143 specific lead-specific cleanings took place in homes. 1,483 windows were replaced in 106 homes. 47 contractors were trained in lead-safe work practices. 140 landlords and other homeowners were worked with to address lead hazards in their properties. In fact, Madam Chair, and members, the state funds that you provide are the only resources we have right now for conducting education and screening in greater Minnesota. Funds don't exist outside of the Twin Cities to do those efforts, and the funds you provide allow us to get out state and conduct that work. And I think, Madam Chair, members, too often childhood lead poisoning is viewed as an urban problem, which there is a substantial problem in the urban core, but it doesn't just exist there. In 2006, 76 counties in Minnesota had at least one child with lead poisoning based on CDC guidelines. In fact, Madam Chair, members, only 22% of children were screened in that year. As I mentioned earlier in my testimony, the state funds that you provided not only draw down a dollar-for-dollar match for the ClearCorps, AmeriCorps-sponsored program, they were also used in the last round of HUD grants for Hennepin County. And the dollars that are on the table for fiscal year 2009 that the governor has recommended eliminating were used in that grant application for the local match to draw down $1.42 million in HUD dollars for the program that we're operating in Hennepin County. So losing those dollars in 2009 would jeopardize that HUD grant we have going on right now, and we would fall short of our goals and objectives, and that would put us in a very precarious situation about 2.5 years from now when we go forward to reapply for HUD dollars in Minnesota. Madam Chair and members, as I wrap up my comments, I want to touch on a few points. As Governor Carlson mentioned, prevention is key. We know that exposure to lead by children under the age of 6 years has effects on neurological development, including lowered intelligence, decreased coordination, aggressive behavior, and learning disorders. Lead poisoning continues to be a problem for all of Minnesota and contributes to unnecessary health care, educational, and social costs. In fact, the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy and the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy also estimated that the costs of lead poisoning in Minnesota to date equal $1.2 billion per year. In fact, Madam Chair, there's also recent and although very preliminary research that also suggests that lead exposure may also be linked to Alzheimer's disease, which is a long-term, very expensive healthcare problem for Americans. Madam Chair, members, we just got this program up and running with the dollars you funded in the last budget bill. We've got our AmeriCorps volunteers hired, trained, ready to go. They're out there working right now. And if we were to lose the 09 appropriation, it would be an immediate shutdown of those activities. And I also think it would jeopardize some of the activities we're trying to do with that HUD grant in Hennepin County. So, Madam Chair and members, really urge you to maintain that $388,000 appropriation for fiscal year 09. With that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
Are there any questions? If not, thank you very much. Bruce Nelson.
Madam Chair, members of the division, thank you. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers that support people with disabilities in the various waivers and ICFCMR. Our members, about 150 of them, employ about 30,000 direct support professionals across the state with a combined payroll of about $361 million of money that, because of the low wages of folks, pretty much stays local. With me today is Rita McAnich Hastings, who has spent her life in commitment to people with disabilities, 34 years as a direct support professional. ARM and we're all very sensitive to the challenges that you face, and I don't envy the task you have ahead of you. But and you're making your tough budget decisions. But as a starting point, the governor's budget, I have to say I find it appalling in several ways. Number one, it puts an incredible burden on health and human services with the cuts in that area. When we have an economic downturn, that's the time when people are most in need, and it's not the time to dig in and make the cuts in the very supports that people need to when they lose their jobs and they need health care and they need help. To focus the cuts on health and human services is in my mind, simply wrong. Senator Berglund, I believe you mentioned yesterday that $398 million is taken out of the health care access fund. That money was intended for a specific purpose for people with working families and children for their health care. And as Governor Carlson said, that was for a specific purpose. And when you combine that with the other cuts, a figure I heard yesterday is 56% of the cuts and transfers are focused in the governor's budget on health and human services, and in my mind is wrong. Our folks are nicked and hit in a number of ways in the governor's budget, but particularly the COLA. And I find it really ironic that the governor, when he says he delays the COLA, it's really, a phrase that comes to mind is money delayed is money denied. And it's not a delay, it's an actual cut. And the irony, I think, is that at the same time that he would put, in his budget would put the burden on people with disabilities and direct support professionals and other people are cut, would reduce the sales tax by 0.8%. So in essence, people like Rita are going to be shouldering the burden with a lost COLA to pay for a tax cut for everybody else. An analogy comes to mind. The baseball opener in Major League Baseball is March 31st. And imagine that the two teams are private sector direct support professionals. And the other team is direct support professionals who work for the state. They do exactly the same work. One is a state employee, one team is a state employee, and one is private. Now, last year, in increases, in the first inning of the game, state employees went ahead 3-2, a 3% increase, and the private sector direct support professionals 2%. Now, under this budget, the score in the second inning would be 3-0. So after just two innings, the state employee direct support professionals who do exactly the same work as the private sector are ahead 6-2. And it's just simply not fair, in my mind, for the 100,000 workers in nursing homes, DTNHs, our services, to have that kind of disparity. You know, I'm very concerned about cuts to programs and providers, obviously, because as Governor Carlson said, we've got to pay the electric bill and so forth. But my main concern is about people and people with disabilities and direct support professionals. If we move ahead with this kind of a cut, people with disabilities are going to suffer. There will be increasing turnover. We see it in our data every year. The lower the wages, the higher the turnover. That means instability in people's lives as you have new people coming in and out and in and out. And it means higher cost to providers for training and marketing and all those things. And it has obviously a tremendous impact on people, on direct support professionals. Their wages right now average about $11 an hour. And with that, it's difficult enough to meet basic needs like groceries, gas at the pump, utilities. And to deny another just modest increase to these folks is really going to stretch them really beyond the ability to pay for basic things. So with that, I'd like to turn it over, if I may, Madam Chair, to Rita, who tell a little bit on a personal side, because this does get down to people, on what the proposed cut in the COLA would mean to her. So with that, Rita?
Well, I should start with telling you that I started with working for the state of Minnesota, and obviously getting traded to a different team somewhere along the line was a poor plan on my part, since it has meant a decrease in wages now over the last 34 years. But when I did work for the state of Minnesota, they would freeze our positions. We were grossly underpaid, and basically the same thing that we're finding in the nonprofit sector. I did explain to my mortgage company that that the governor has talked about delaying my COLA for a year, and my mortgage company doesn't care. Neither does Xcel Energy or any of my other bills, of which I don't have a lot of bills because I live a pretty basic lifestyle. I did not get into this field because a voice came to me in the middle of the night, because I dreamt that this would be a good thing to do. This is not a vocation, and I think we should be clear about this. We do not get into this field. We do not do this line of work because we feel that we are special people that have a higher calling to work with people with disabilities. We get into this field because we really like our jobs, and we stay in this field not because we can't get a different job. So I talked to a colleague of mine the other day, and he said, you know, Rita, I think that people think that we're just not smart enough to do anything else. Because if we were smart enough, we would be looking for the corner office with the windows and the higher salary. It is not because we can't do a different job. It's because we choose to do what we do because we're really good at what we do. And what we are good at is helping individuals with disabilities realize the kind of life that everyone should be able to lead without all of the hurdles that they have to jump over.
And so in payment for that, we get a modest salary that doesn't even cover the bills. And what is happening in this field is that people are losing their homes because they can't pay their mortgages, that people are dropping their health insurance. Because for a family of three in this field, in the nonprofit field, it costs on average $900 a month. That's what we pay before our before anything else gets paid. That comes out of our check directly. If you make $11 an hour, how do you pay $900 in insurance? So we have people losing their homes, dropping their health care, living just above the poverty line of the people that they serve. And as my generation gets to the point where we are going to be retiring, we look around to see who is going to take our place. You have 4 years of college you're going to get. You're then going to apply for a job in nonprofit human services, the private sector, and they're going to hire you for $10 an hour. Would you take that job? They're going to tell you that your insurance for one person is going to come to somewhere around $240 a month. Would you want that benefit? And then they're going to tell you that no matter how well you do your job, that every year, whether or not you get a raise is going to depend upon the whims of somebody in office who feels that because you do not have a loud enough voice, that they can delay your raise or take it away altogether. It has nothing to do with your merit. It has nothing to do with your abilities. It has nothing to do with the kind of job you do. Would you go into that field? Now, in the next few years, we are going to need another 1.3 million people to come into this field. Where are we going to find those people? How are we going to hire them? How are we going to keep them? I asked my legislator the other day when I was talking to him, what is the state's plan if you continue to not fund this particular part of the budget? What is the state going to do for people with physical and cognitive disabilities? Where are you going to find the people to work with them? Because the people I work with, the people I work for, are not going to go back into state regional centers. They know their rights. They're taxpayers and they vote too. They also know that they have a right to a certain lifestyle and they work very, very hard. They are not sitting at home. They're out there working every single day. But they also know that it is a team effort of people who both have the disabilities and those of us who support them to get them to where they want to go. It is a team effort, and we do a really good job. But we can only do that job if we can keep people in this field that have that kind of ability to want to do this kind of work. And that is up to you.
Are there any questions? Thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the work you do.
Thank you.
And Henry?
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the division. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society. We represent children and adults with significant disabilities across Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the proposed budget. Before I get started on the five items on the handout, I just would like to reflect for a moment on the fact that Persons with disabilities, as you have already heard, have experienced severe cuts going back to 2002. Most of those cuts have not been restored, and now we're seeing more on these pages. Today you're going to hear from a number of families who have been affected by those cuts over the past 6 years. I'm going to concentrate a little bit more on some numbers and other items. The first item is on budget page 58, and it's the reduction for the CADI and TBI waiver enrollment. CADI stands for Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, TBI, Traumatic Brain Injury. And as you know, these programs are for people eligible for institutional care in a nursing home or neurobehavioral hospital, but can stay in the community with support services. These cuts are going to result in waiting lists. We had enrollment cuts in 2003. They were continued in 2005, and we did have waiting lists. These enrollment limits are a little higher than we had during that period, but we fully expect, and based on their numbers, we can see that they're projecting that that nearly 1,000 people who need these services won't be getting them after this proposal is in effect for 3 years on the budget page. We are, however, pleased to see that on this page there are two proposals for housing subsidies, and we support those. The proposals are designed to help people who are now in four-bed homes, paid for in part with services through these waivers, that can move out and be more independent. We really support those two proposals. I want to make one last point on this page, and that is that the cuts on the page have to be looked at in terms of their service impact. Because these programs are covered by Medicaid, we get half federal match. So if you add the money on this page and the page regarding MINDO, which I will talk about next, we have a net service cut of $68 million in disability services over the next 3 years for this population. Now, this is not money that's stuffed in a mattress or in a cookie jar. This money is used to employ people. It is used to build ramps. It is used for supported employment services. This money circulates in the economy. And we are basically turning our back on half federal match. The second item is the freeze to the MINDO waiver services. This is on budget page 51. MINDO is the Minnesota Disability Health Option, and I know you'll hear more about that from other testifiers today. Let me just say this cut is related to the one I just talked about with CADI and TBI services. It's separating out community support services from this voluntary integrated managed care program. This program now serves about 900 people in the metro area, and it basically goes to the very heart of the program and completely changes it because the community side of the services are taken out. We don't support this at all. The third item you have just heard about, the community services COLA, I would just echo the testimony that you have just heard and emphasize again that besides the $33 million cut on the page, we are turning our backs on another $27 million in federal money, which would be matched. And again, as you've heard, this money is not stuffed in a mattress or put in a cookie jar. It has a significant economic impact, and I think the economic impact would far exceed the eighth of a cent cut in the sales tax. The people who get this money are among our lowest paid healthcare workers, and they will certainly have to spend the money. Fourth are cuts in costs to counties. I'm not going to enumerate them all. I know you'll hear more about that, but we are very concerned about them because people with disabilities do rely on the counties, and this will mean that they will have less access to services. I do want to point out, however, that we really don't support making those four counties who overspent their DD waiver in 2004 or 2005 pay the money back. During that period of time, the DD waiver was not overspent statewide. We had always managed that program as a statewide program. Some counties were up some years, some counties were down. The way to deal with this problem, I think, has been implemented, which is better technology for the counties, better management, better technical assistance from the department. We believe forcing these four counties to pay this money back is going to instead hurt people with disabilities. It's not going to hurt anyone else. This will hurt other vulnerable people in the county, but it will be well known that this is happening because of the developmental disabilities waiver problems. The other issue with counties is the targeted case management page, which is labeled federal compliance. We hope that the approach here is flexible because we are aware that there's action in Congress to establish a moratorium on the targeted case management interim rule and five other harsh rules. And we are working hard with many, many groups to see that that moratorium happens. And so we want these services in federal match to continue, and hopefully that will be the case. And finally, the fetal alcohol cut, I can't say it better than Governor Carlson. We fully support the continuation of this. It really is an investment that saves money. Thank you. And we will work with you as this process continues.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks again. Deborah Schlick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, I'm Deborah Schlick. I'm with the Affirmative Options Coalition. We are a coalition of more than 50 organizations around the state of Minnesota. Some of our members do direct service with low-income individuals. Others are advocates. Others are faith-based social justice advocates. We want to speak to the parts of the governor's budget proposal that would refinance TANF and make some changes in the Minnesota Family Investment Program. Our concern with the governor's budget is twofold. It seems not to reflect the forecast, which was very clear that the revenue shortfalls are about a weakening and worsening economy, a labor market that is losing jobs, not gaining jobs. Our second concern is it's not a realistic budget. We are aware that by making some unrealistic assumptions, what the governor has done is left to you some very hard decisions about where to make realistic decisions in that budget. We also noted that one of the differences between the November and the February forecast was that now the forecast anticipates that there will be a 3% increase in the Minnesota Family Investment Program caseload, the state's welfare to work program. And I want to explain why a weak labor market leads to an increase in the caseload. In fact, researchers from the University of Michigan say the rule of thumb is that for every 1% increase in the unemployment rate, you can anticipate a 7% increase in public assistance caseloads. And 15 years of experience has borne out that rule of thumb. Welfare is the unemployment insurance program for many low-wage working parents. The Government Accountability Office did a report for Congress last year that among its key findings, low-wage workers are 2.5 times more likely to lose a job, only half as likely to qualify or get any unemployment benefits. And inside our own state, a research project the Department of Human Services undertook with 7 sample counties for more than 3 years learned in that survey process that the most common reason parents apply for cash assistance in Minnesota is that they have just lost a job. So our concern in that environment about refinancing the TANF reserves are that, first of all, we've often heard those funds referred to, like the health care access funds, as a surplus. We object to the term surplus. We think when there are almost 500,000 Minnesotans uninsured, when there are 150,000 children in poverty, that the funds dedicated to solve those problems can't be characterized as a surplus when the mission is unaccomplished. And we think that spending the TANF reserves has 3 problems. It's a lost opportunity. We're using one-time money for ongoing costs, and we leave no reserves for continuing demand in what looks like is going to be an economy with problems in the next couple of years. The lost opportunity is these are safety net funds. They're workforce funds. And like the proposed refinancing of the workforce development funds and the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership funds and for DEED, these are the funds we ought to deploy during a weak labor market not deplete. We would, we think there are ways to use these safety net funds to help people get and keep work in a poor labor market. We're also concerned that as we look at the TANF reserves, that each year we can expect about $10 million to come into that account. That means most of the rest of the $91 million that is proposed to be refinanced is one-time money. We've done that before in this state, taken out ongoing allocations and replaced it with one-time TANF funds. It did huge damage to our child care program. It set the child care program up for the devastating cuts that occurred in 2003. We also think that in an environment where you spend down all of your reserves, that anything that appears on the budget as a proposed delay is, in fact, a cut next year. There will be no money to implement efforts like the work bonus that are prepared to be delayed a year from now. So finally, we understand that it will make sense to use some of the reserves. What we would hope to see is that some of those reserves are used for very targeted, specific efforts that help people get and keep jobs during this economic downturn, and that we would use no more of the reserves of special funds like TANF or Healthcare Access Fund in any greater proportion than the budget proposes to use the general fund cash reserves, which are not proposed to be zeroed out like these, and that we not take one-time money and replace ongoing funds in programs and make them vulnerable for deep cuts next year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Fabulous testimony.
Mark Peterson.
Madam Chair, members of the division, I want to first of all say thank you for your service to the people of Minnesota. You have accepted a significant calling to help assure that the people of Minnesota live and work in community with dignity, safety, and hope. You have a very important piece of work that you do day in and day out, and I'm grateful for that commitment that you have. My name is Mark Peterson. I'm the CEO of Lutheran Social Service. We are Minnesota's oldest and largest human service organization. We serve persons from every county in the state with service that covers the lifespan. As such, we have a particular and, I think, unique perspective about the needs and the desires of the people of the state. In the last couple of years, there have been some very encouraging signs here in Minnesota that thrill us, actually. We're very encouraged by the efforts made in various municipalities to develop plans to end homelessness here in this state. We're very encouraged by the efforts that are being made now to help families that are facing mortgage foreclosure difficulties and seeking to prevent that. We're delighted with the addition of additional opportunities for families seeking affordable housing. We're very pleased with the decision that you made last year to create the commission to end poverty in Minnesota by the year 2020. Faith communities around the state are especially pleased with that decision. At LSS, we're engaged right now in a capital campaign to raise $27 million, which is seven times more money than we've ever raised before for any single project, and we're 86% of the way home. So there are lots of signs of hope. I mentioned these few signs of how Minnesotans are seeking to serve the neighbor because they are signs of hope. Even in this budget, I was pleased to see that there is some money being set aside to help returning military and their families after their stay to their work in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's both important and encouraging. But in many other respects, this budget represents a step backward, not forward. Of particular interest and concern to me is the proposal to not provide long-term care workers a most modest 2% increase in their wages. We employ over 1,000 persons who work with this population. Since 2003, our reimbursement rates have increased 5.5% when the cost of living has been almost treble that. And now we have yet another proposal that takes us further backward. Frankly, I worry that our ability to assure the well-being of the people we serve is compromised by this proposal. I worry that our ability to assure quality care is compromised. I worry, frankly, that our ability to assure the safety of some of the most vulnerable Minnesotans is compromised. The past 5 years have been, from an operating perspective, some of the most difficult in my long career. I pray that you don't make things worse still. I believe that the people of Minnesota want to see their neighbors served and served well. I believe the people of Minnesota believe that we can make things right. I believe that to be a Minnesotan is to be hopeful. This budget is not. I hope that you can find ways to not cut yet again health and human services funding. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thanks for being here today. Mark McAfee.
Madam Chair, members of the division, I'm Mark McAfee with AFSCME Council 5. We have 43,000 workers that we represent in Minnesota, state, county, municipal, school district, university, hospital, long-term care workers. Most of them are public, but we do have some nonprofit. We appreciate the opportunity to comment on the governor's health and human services budget recommendations. After months of talking about health care reform, and of course Senator Berglund has led the effort on the Senate side, the governor proposes to take, and thank you for correcting yesterday, Madam Chair, the as much as $398 million from the health care access funds, and use them to balance the budget. Is anyone really surprised? Those of us that come down here and lobby try to not get too jaded, but I'll confess that sitting over in room 10 of the state office building back when the legislative commission was meeting, and some of us speculated that this probably would happen. The governor talks of health care, but appears to be walking away from it by this proposal. Others have spoken to you about the thousands of people, especially children, that may be denied access to Minnesota care, and we share those concerns. The governor has raised the drawbridge and says no more may enter the program. There's a specific item, two of them, you may recall from, I think, Tuesday's hearing, and they deal with operating budget reductions, presumably central office sorts of things at health and at DHS. And that gets our interest because, of course, we may represent some of the employees there. I recall the assistant commissioner of DHS coming in, and that particular item says an estimated 39 full-time equivalent positions. Usually an estimate is 40 or 50. This is pretty specific. And yet at the hearing, the assistant commissioner stated that DHS would have time to work this through. I think that's a pretty precise amount, and I think rather than a general estimate, and I think this committee certainly deserves to know exactly which positions and which services would be either reduced or eliminated to make a fully informed decision on this change item. We share a concern that Ann Henry mentioned about requiring the counties to reimburse the state for overspending the DD waiver in 2004 and 2005. We're opposed to that. We're also concerned, and I know others around the table are concerned, about the proposal to delay rebasing of inpatient hospital rates till January 2010. The earlier speaker made a very compelling remarks about working in really in long-term care, how people are compensated. In another hat, I chair the Jobs Now Council Board of Directors, and it really comes down to the fact that we're not paying many of these people a living wage. And we are, AFSCME is a member of the Senior Workers for Quality Coalition. You know, you have had or will have Iris Freeman and some of the other folks that represent us, but we have supported a rate increase, rebasing, although on a tighter time frame. And we are very concerned, as others have been, about, in effect, a freeze on long-term care, nursing homes, and the long-term care workers. It's going to create a problem. I think Ann Henry mentioned also, and of course, you know, we've been concerned and involved about what's been going on with the federal proposed rule that affects target case management. We have been part of a coalition that has been pushing very hard to deal with that issue nationally. We're also concerned about child support enforcement, and there have been bills introduced. We hope that you will hear them and consider and watch what's going on at the federal level before you make final decisions on this budget. We think we've been hit with the H-bomb. Once again, Health and Human Services and higher ed, the H programs, and we could add in the healthcare access as ground zero, have been hit with the highest reductions in the governor's supplemental budget. This has happened before. What about solutions? The no new taxes approach isn't working well, and we need to consider if we're going to avoid cuts to programs and services that are still recovering from the cuts of a few years ago, and that many of what you restored in just this last session, and use of the Health Care Access Fund, we need other options. We think using a portion of the rainy day fund, the budget reserve, is appropriate. For the remainder, we need revenues to invest in these services for people. And we're not naive about the political context that we reside in. However, we're among those that are not reluctant to advocate for the closure of tax loopholes or the use of the progressive income tax, considering that we have some very wealthy people in this state that could pay their fair share and help allow the nursing home workers and others get a more decent wage. And we certainly oppose that proposed reduction in the sales tax. We need to exhaust these options before we allow the H-bomb to hit our programs and services. And finally, I think one other aspect that you could consider, Madam Chair, looking at, because I think you'll, of course, you'll want to look under, as you, I know you attempt to do, look under every rock to see where resources may be and how wisely they're being spent. And I think that over at DHS and other agencies, I think if you should examine the contracted services. Obviously, we had a, you know, we've had a whole history with Health Match that's been discussed here. I think you ought to take a look broadly at where the money's being spent, and then consider. And then, of course, you know, we know how tough the decisions will be, but we want to work with you to try to be as positive as we can. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Are there questions? If you find any rocks, let me know. Deb Konitschke.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Deb Konitschke.
And I'm Virginia Weldon.
And we're going to share the testimony today. We are with the Welfare Rights Committee. The Welfare Rights Committee is an organization of current and former welfare recipients, working poor, low-income people. We're also part of a statewide coalition, the Minnesota Welfare Rights Coalition. We are being presented this year with the same old story that took place in 2003. And Governor Pawlenty is presenting the people of Minnesota with the same old sorry response. The state is in a budget deficit. The governor's solution? Cut from the poor. Cut from people with disabilities. Cut from the sick and those who do not have the money to be able to afford health insurance. Who has to pay for this deficit? Once again, Governor Pawlenty says that those of us with the least ability to pay will be the ones to pay for this deficit. Once again, he is balancing the budget on the backs of poor and working Minnesotans. Pawlenty's budget is a proposal filled with theft. It steals over $90 million from poor families by taking it out of the TANF funds. It steals hundreds of millions from health care access funds for people who cannot afford health insurance. TANF dollars are federal dollars that are supposed to be spent on welfare for children and caregivers in poverty. It is illegal to steal TANF dollars to supplant general fund spending. It is immoral to steal money from the survival programs for low-income and working families in order to balance a budget deficit. The fact remains, poor and working families did not create this budget deficit. We should not be the ones to pay for it. Not once does Governor Pawlenty talk about cutting from those who have so much money that it's really disgusting to the rest of us. Not once does he talk about the billions in permanent tax breaks given to the richest in this state. Replacing state general fund dollars with TANF funds is nothing but a shell game designed to take money from Minnesota's poorest families, mothers, and children in order to protect these tax breaks for the wealthiest Minnesotans. Those of us who are being squeezed from every side have the solution to the budget deficit: tax the rich. This state and country are in a recession. A recession means that we do not need less programs for unemployed workers and poor families. It means we need more. It means more and more will fill the ranks of the unemployed and those in poverty. It means more and more will fill the lines at the welfare offices. Once that job is yanked from us and that unemployment insurance runs out, all that we have left is to go down and apply for welfare. Because as we all know, there just simply are not enough jobs to go around.
The difference this time around is Pawlenty is only the governor. He cannot cut all these necessary programs or steal all these funds unless the elected lawmakers in this capital allow him to. If he is allowed to get away with this devious scheme to steal from poor, disabled, and sick, it will be because he was not stopped. It is the moral responsibility of all conscientious legislatures to stop these proposals dead in their tracks. We are counting on you to do this. Furthermore, there are bills, Senate Files 3290 and 3242, that use the TANF dollars for TANF families. While Governor Pawlenty devises new schemes to steal from the poor, we are still dealing with the devastating cuts he did to us in 2003. Families on welfare saw our monthly survival grants cut by as much as one-third. Families on welfare have not seen the welfare grant increase to keep up with the cost of living for 22 years. To top that off, Pawlenty and many others want us to work for free. What do you think a pool of free labor does to an already depressed labor market? Senate File 3290 and 3242 will fix these things. Welfare, welfare, welfare. How many times already this year have we heard certain politicians go after welfare? One might ask, why all the focus on welfare? It must cost so much, it needs to be reined in. You ask people on the streets, and after hearing welfare rate over the coals so many times over here at the Capitol, they honestly think that welfare for poor families must use up 40 to 60% of the state budget. When welfare is repeatedly and constantly dragged through the mud, why would anyone think any different? The fact is, welfare for poor families in Minnesota uses up less than half of 1% of the state budget. That's half of 1% of the state budget. The reality is, Governor Pawlenty and others who like to bash the poor think it's easy to beat up on poor women and children. They think they can win political points by criminalizing us and then slashing our programs. It is up to the conscientious legislatures in this capital to stop the ugly game that is going on. Silence is not an option. The time is long overdue. Our families have suffered too long and too much. It is time to stop. Don't balance the budget on our backs. Make the rich pay for the budget deficit, not poor and working Minnesotans.
Are there any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Shephorster?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is George Shephorster. I'm a family physician from St. Cloud, and I'm speaking on behalf, as president-elect of the Minnesota Medical Association that represents about 11,000 members across the state. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to be here to speak to the governor's 2008 supplemental budget proposal. MMA recognizes that this $935 million budget deficit for this year will be a challenging financial situation, and it makes me glad that I'm sitting on this side of the table. But I believe that as you wrestle with this, these decisions, some perspective is important, and I'd like to take a couple minutes to make a few points. For the current biennium, just under 30% of the state's budget is spent on health and human services. That is a significant number, but I think it's reflective of the state's values and commitments to protecting the health of all Minnesotans and to providing health care to the most vulnerable members of the society. But while we spend nearly 30% on health and human services, you'll notice that almost 56% of the budget fix proposed by the governor is at the expense of these services. Furthermore, the governor intends to raid the health care access fund to the tune of $300 million during the 2009 fiscal year, with some suggestion that it would impose new commitments of up to $100 million through the next biennium. Please remember, this fund was established and dedicated for the purpose of expanding access and coverage for otherwise uninsured Minnesotans. But now the governor intends that nearly one-third of the entire budget deficit would be balanced by using this state sick tax. Please recognize that by stealing from the health care access fund, this further undermines the ability of the state to meet its obligations to those Minnesotans who are already eligible for Minnesota care. For all the work and commitment over the past 8 months of many to develop meaningful health care reform proposals and to ensure health care coverage for all Minnesotans, this budget flies in the face of those commitments. Not surprisingly, the physicians of Minnesota are outraged. This proposal is an affront to all of the hardworking professionals in this state and to their patients on whose back this cost is ultimately borne. I would like to add that I personally feel like this is a slap in my face. As you probably know, the very existence of the sick tax has been a point of contention for physicians, and for over 10 years, I've worked very hard to try to convince my peers that this fund is important in providing, improving access to health care. But to once again steal that money to balance the budget rather than through some other means that more fairly distributes the pain across the entire population greatly impacts my credibility with my peers. As you know, over the past 5 years, the physicians and patients of this state have watched as more than over $400 million have been siphoned from this dedicated fund to shore up the general fund. We feel enough is enough. So despite its temptation, I strongly urge you to oppose using this health care access fund to balance the state's budget. I urge you to maintain the integrity of this fund and to support the health care needs of the low-income Minnesotans. When this fund is used as is intended, the physicians of Minnesota are prepared to do their part. We cannot, however, sit by and let this fund continue to be raided for non-healthcare purposes. The health of the Minnesotans is way too important. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you again. We are going to start skipping around just a little bit here. I'd like to take Debbie Harris next.
Good
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I do appreciate your time in listening to us today. My name is Debbie Harris. I'm from Eagan. This is my little son, Joshua, and he goes to Eagan High School, but there have, as you might have seen on the news last night, there's a lice epidemic there. Josh is not going to be in school for a couple days. I'm here to talk about the parental fees for parents who are average income parents who pay a fee for a program called TEFRA so that our children with special health care needs and disabilities can have access to medical assistance. We pay for private insurance through my husband's employer, but because the cost for Josh's care are extraneous, someone has to be with him 24 hours a day, and he has to have licensed nursing because he has a trach and respiratory problems. We pay the fee so that we can cover co-payments and other extraneous costs and have availability of more resources. Right now, private insurance is capping nursing care greatly, so we pay TEFRA to have access to MA so Josh can have a waiver for his nursing services. The parental fee, when we first started out, was something we could handle as a family. I did leave my job, a full-time job as a technical writer years ago, so that Josh could have more consistent care at home. He had been harmed a number of times because we didn't have qualified staff at the time caring for him and had to be hospitalized about four times. So my husband and I made that decision, and I do help to fill in for when he doesn't have nursing care, which is much of the time. The TEFRA fee was something we could handle a few years ago, but in the past few years has actually, for our family, I'm not sure what the percentage is, but it's many hundreds of dollars per month. And as we all face very critical economic times, families like mine are really worried because it's something we need to pay. We want to keep our children at home. But it's an extra burden to have several hundred dollars coming out of my husband's income every month to pay for the parental fee. I do want to say, though, that we're thankful for the resources that are available in Minnesota for children with complex needs and disabilities. Because we've made great strides in being able to keep our children with us at home. But as we look into the budget, I would just ask that there be some relief for families who are paying the high TEFRA fee for their children. When my husband, he was in the Marine Corps and was activated for duty a couple of times. The first time, he was gone for 18 months from home, and we didn't have nursing care because the military said they didn't pay for kids who couldn't be fixed. So we weren't able to get nursing care for Joshua at the time. So in addition to paying our high TEFRA fee, while my husband's income went down because he had gone from his private, his civilian job to his military pay, in addition to paying our TEFRA fee, we also had to pay thousands of dollars in COBRA to keep our very minimal. Thank you, Josh. Josh is 15, so he makes comments about everything I say. we had to pay thousands of dollars in COBRA just to keep the minimal nursing services that were provided through our private insurance as well. So it is a big burden for families. It's something that, as we all are looking forward to very difficult economic times, it's an extra, kind of an extra tax for families like ours because it doesn't go up a little percentage. It hasn't gone up a little percentage. It's gone up many, many times. So right now we're paying several hundred dollars a month. And even though we are thankful for our services, we do need some relief. Thank you for your time.
Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you
very much for coming today. Marion Aiken.
Cost.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, my name is Marian Aiken, and I'm also a parent, and I'm here to talk about a couple of different things, the COLA as well as the parental fees. But I want to thank all of you for giving me this opportunity to come and speak with you on these issues. As for the COLA, we're really running into some problems with staffing for my daughter, who's 15, who was born 2 months premature due to fetal maternal hemorrhage. She's had a lot of countless medical. Her list of diagnoses is probably a page long. She has 20 subspecialists that we see. Currently, there's like 12 or more that we have to see on an ongoing basis. Some we have to see weekly. In fact, after I'm done here, we have to go on to doctor's appointments. Amanda is 15 years old. Like I said, she's a beautiful little girl. The doctors didn't give us much hope when she was born, but she did survive. With her diagnosis, we're constantly on the go. We can be having a good day, and all of a sudden we crash, and we're taken to the hospital. And living in rural Minnesota, New Ulm, we always have to come up here for these services. So with the COLA, one of the things is we need to have good staff, because without the good staff, my daughter's health as well as her safety comes into a factor. She has no concept of pain, and if she does, it's misdirected, so we never know where she's hurting, so it comes out in behavior. So when you're working with her and she's having a medical issue, it's like a hide-and-seek game. Where is it? What's going on? We take her to our doctors, and then we're sent up here, and then, again, it's the same issues. So we really need to have these, because with the amount of money that people are getting paid to do these services, you know, they're not sticking around. You know, when their child is yelling and screaming, "You're not my mom," out in the public, "You can't take me away," not saying it's a PCA. We've had times that, you know, police or other people intervene, and it's hard to explain why. She also is one that'll say, "Quit hitting me, quit hitting me," when nobody's even near her. So we really got to go through those struggles as well as the medical. And sometimes the staff is like, "You know what? I can't keep getting, you know, talked to by police or other people, you know, thinking I'm abusing this poor kid." So we run into those factors. The other thing is I also work in the home health. I service the kids, the adults with disabilities in their homes. I take them to their doctor's appointments. I do the reports and make sure that they're safe in their home. So it actually reflects for me as well with that cost of living adjustment. With Mandy and her disabilities, we were told, you know, when she was going to be released from the hospital that we were going to need some help and support staff. And at that time, I thought, you know what, I've had kids before, you know, I know how to raise them, I wouldn't need that. I had a social worker that came to me and told me, you know, by not taking these services, what you're going to do is an injustice to your whole family. Because if you're not going to do that, you're going to have it where you are taking care of your daughter all day long, and then dad comes home and it's like, you know what, you take over. I haven't had an opportunity to clean. I haven't had an opportunity for nothing. Her alarms are going off, her heart, you know, and everything. So then it's like dad comes home from a stressful job, and then he's got to take over and stuff. Even though you have support staff, you really have to stay on top of things to make sure things are going well, or there's going to be another trip to the hospital. So with all that said, you know, then dad starts staying later at the office because he doesn't want to come home because, you know, the situation at the house. And then it just escalates from there. And then we have another child at home who has been the core of our lives for 8 years before our daughter was born, that he's going to start saying, "Hey, mom and dad don't have time for me. They don't have time to do nothing." You know, and then they start to slide back, and then they start having issues and that. And we did start seeing that. But with the help and the support that we've had, we were able to dedicate our lives and separate my daughter's life as well as my son's and get the different things going. So with that said, that's why the help and support staff has really been wonderful. The problem that we face was a lethal combination. When you talk about money, they say that the most problems in domestic violence or that is due to money. And then when you have a child with a disability tossed in there, you know, in their surgeries and everything else, you know, they say that the statistically speaking, kids with disabilities tend to get more abused than any other child because they take up so much more time. They take a toll on your senses and everything else because, you know, you had a stressful day and then they come up and then they have all these other issues or they're screaming and carrying on. My daughter has explosive behaviors and we're not sure why. She'll be in this room and she'll be doing fine. She'll be smiling and acting really nice. And then the next minute, we don't know why, she'll just become very, very explosive. She'll be hitting, she'll be screaming, she'll be thrashing out and herself, banging her head and everything. So, you know, we really, you know, when they're going through that, of course, you get escalated and stuff. And it takes a long time to come down from that. When we started paying our parental fees, we had to pay over $500 a month just for my daughter's care. My husband works full-time at a good job. We are paying for his insurance through his employer, which was good. After we pay out our $1,000 deductible just on Amanda and a $2,500 on family, his insurance pays 100% of her care. The problem is, when you're paying out that kind of money, it really takes a toll on your budget. We cannot afford to pay that. And a few years back, you did reduce the parental fees, which was really nice. Ours went down to $350 a month, which was really nice. But we still couldn't pay that amount. So when we were hit with the $500 and then the $350, we cannot afford to pay that. If we did, we'd really be in jeopardy. We had to put two additions onto our house. The one addition was for my daughter's safety for her maneuvering. Our doorways were not 36 inches wide to accommodate. We tried looking at buying a new home. Or first, we were looking to just purchase an existing home. None of them would fit our needs. We were looking at to buy a new home. We couldn't find one. So we had to put an addition onto our house so we can have main floor bedrooms that had 36-inch doors. So we had to put that on. And then my daughter has real bad bowel issues as well as cerebral palsy. And Amanda, with her disabilities, we really needed to get a hot tub. She was having countless surgeries. We had to keep going in for bowel cleanouts. And, you know, and we're talking like almost every month we were going into the hospital for these procedures. One of the things that we found out was that if she was in a hot tub, it would relax her muscles enough where we could do her therapies and get her to move around a little better. We were also able to help that with her bowels. For whatever reason, it relaxed her so much where she was able to have bowel movements without any extra support, no surgeries, or no going in for cleanouts. And we talked about a gastrostomy tube and everything, but she kept playing with things and pulling them out, and then that's another hospitalization. So the hot tub was a wonderful medical device for us. So we had to put, we got the hot tub and stuff, and then with the weather, we couldn't take her out in the winter if it rained or whatever, so we had to put another addition on that for the hot tub so it would be withstanding of the weather conditions, as well as she wouldn't have to get, excuse me, my mouth is getting really dry, so but we didn't have to take her to get risk her health. And the best thing, and you know, there was no mold the way we have it set up or anything, so, you know, that was just phenomenal. With the parental fees, though, going back to that, paying the $350, you know, it really took a major, major toll on us. And what happened was we haven't been paying the full amount. You know, we just couldn't. Well, then what happened was we were contacted just recently that we owe over $14,000 in back, parental fees. And they wanted the money now. And we told them we just could not afford to pay it. And they said, well, can't you put it on a charge card? Can't you take out a loan? And it's like, you know what? If we do that, it's only going to put us more at risk. We can't do that because if we're paying somebody else out and we still have to pay those $350, we're not going to come out ahead. So we're really running into some tolls with that. One of the things, too, is with my daughter on the waivered services, they also told us at our county at one point we really had to struggle that they were going to reduce my daughter's my daughter's programs and her benefits because of the budget. And I really had to struggle and work through our county and say, you know what, you can't base it on struggle. You need to do an assessment. You need to see where her needs are and go from there. So we were able to do a little bit with that, but one of the things that they told me is that the waivered services are not a given. And even though we're already on the waiver program, they can also take her off of it. So that is also concerning to us. With all of that said, I really thank all of you for the support that you have shown in the past, and we really hope that you'll show support in the future. I also want to thank yous. You did give a little bit of money towards a medical home grant that has really benefited families and children with disabilities.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you again.
Oh, Madam Chair. Yes. Oh.
Senator Rosen.
I'm sorry. I just had a real question for Mrs. Aiken. Who was it from the state that called you to ask for you to pay off your debt?
I can't remember her name offhand. I'm a little nervous right now. I know that I talked to Ann Henry. Ann, do you remember who it was that we said that?
Well, it's someone at the Department of Human
Services. Right. She said somebody from the Department of Human Services and the Recovery Division.
Any other questions? Senator.
Madam Chair, I would be curious to know what the practice is at the department if someone's in arrears, if they're calling and encouraging people to put it on charge cards or what it is that their activities are at that point. It's just to report out what's happening.
Any other questions?
If you want, I can get that name, and then I can, pass it on.
All right. Any other questions?
One of the other things that I really want to say, if I can talk 2 more minutes. What they did was they cold called my husband and told him that if we did not pay this in full, they were going to garnish his wages. And that happened just before the holidays. So that really took a toll. The other thing that happened was, just so you are aware, our state refunds automatically go back to the state. We do not reciprocate from that at all. And we did not reduce our deductions or, anything or higher them up just so it reduces our state back because we thought that is one way we can give back.
Great. Thank you very much. Mary Braddock.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mary Braddock, and I'm a pediatrician at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, where I also serve as our Director of Child Health Policy. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and its 145 members, I want to thank you for this opportunity to express our strong concern with the administration's Health and Human Services budget recommendations. Before highlighting the components of the budget proposal that the hospital community is most concerned about, I think it is important to mention that we are very pleased that the governor's budget recommendation did not include yet another round of rateable reductions in the Medicaid program. Regrettably, the 3 previously imposed inpatient hospital rate reductions are still in place. The budget cuts made in 2002, 2003, and 2005, when added together, total an 11.5% cut to hospital inpatient payment rates. And because these cuts are cumulative, there is a loss of approximately $293 million in payment reductions for the 08 and 09 biennium. Because of federal matching funds, protecting the medical assistant rate is important to the hospital community. And at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, 37.4% of our revenue comes from medical assistance. Any reductions in Medicaid program then disproportionately affect those hospitals such as Children's that serve the greatest number of low-income patients and also many times take care of the very sickest of those patients. The hospital community's specific issues of concern within the governor's budget are 3. The first is delay of inpatient hospital rebasing. When serving medical assistance patients, hospitals are currently paid at 2002 costs minus that 11.5% rateable reduction. Rebasing is currently scheduled to occur in January of 2009, bringing hospital payments up to 2004 cost minus the 11.5%. This rebasing delay means that hospitals would have payment rates based on costs from 6 years ago minus 11.5%. For hospitals like Children's, where our services must constantly change based on rapidly improving treatments, rapidly changing technologies for the most fragile and sickest children in our region, this is especially problematic. At Minneapolis and St. Paul Children's Hospitals and Clinics, this delay of rebasing will cost us $13.5 million. The impact to hospitals statewide is calculated at $76.7 million when you add in the federal match. And this cut affects disproportionately few hospitals serving the poorest and the sickest patients in our state. Not only my own institution, Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, but St. Luke's and St. Mary's in Duluth, the hospital in Bemidji, Hennepin County Medical Center, Regents Hospital, Gillette Children's Specialty Health Care, and Fairview University Medical Hospital, a small number of our members disproportionately being impacted by these cuts. Our second issue is the elimination of the inpatient hospital supplemental payments, also known as disproportional share hospital payments, or DSH. And this has been one of the most frequent, frustrating issues that hospitals have dealt with for the last 5 years. In 2003, the federal government increased by 16% the amount of DSH money available to states such as Minnesota receiving low amounts of federal DSH dollars. It was the intent of the federal government that this money be used for hospital payments. Current Minnesota law has a distribution formula allocating a higher percentage of the monies which serve to hospitals which serve the poorest patients. So far, these additional DSH dollars have not been leveraged as the legislature intended, and we have been extremely frustrated about that. We continue to believe that it was not the federal government's intent to use this money for other health and human service expenditure needs, and to date, none of us have seen any of these DSH payments. The Minnesota Department of Human Services has been intent, we believe, on taking this money long before there was a budget crisis. And we hope for the sake of this budget division's difficult deliberations that the department will finally leverage this money because it would produce an additional $58 million in funds for the fiscal years 08 through 011. Our third concern is what you've already heard about from other speakers, namely the transferring of dollars from the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund. Like all healthcare providers who collect the Minnesota care tax from our patients, we continue to object to the healthcare access funds being transferred to the general fund. Legislators should be aware, and you probably are, how much money this has involved. $192 million in 2005, $52 million in 2006, and nearly $60 million last year. If these funds had not been diverted for other purposes, Minnesota would be well on its way towards meeting the goal of universal coverage for our vulnerable populations. If a portion of the healthcare access fund dollars are once again tapped to solve the current budget shortfall, we need to pass a corresponding refilling mechanism such as Governor Carlson talked about earlier this morning and not continue to raid this healthcare access fund. In addition to the direct transfer of healthcare access fund dollars to the general fund, there is also in the governor's budget the issue of funding source substitution, where healthcare programs currently paid for out of the general fund would now be paid for out of the healthcare access fund. The long-term policy consequences of such a major funding change must be fully vetted and not quickly enacted without deep and detailed discussion. Undoubtedly, Madam Chairman and members, you have a very difficult budget decision that you are being asked to make. Because of the dollar-for-dollar federal match in the medical assistance program, we ask you to do whatever you can to help us continue serving our most vulnerable patients, children, the very sick, and the poor. Thank you for your consideration.
Questions? Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Grace Petrie.
I just have 8 to 11 here. I don't have any. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today about Governor Pawlenty's proposed budget and its possible consequences for vulnerable nursing home residents and those who are receiving long-term care services throughout the state. My name is Grace Petrie from Virginia, Minnesota, and I am a member of AARP, Volunteer Grassroots Election and Advocacy Great Team. I'm also a Minnesotan with an aunt in it who is currently living in an assisted living facility, and I am representing the Seniors and Workers for Quality Coalition. I am a retired person now, but worked for 26 years for St. Louis County as a supervisor for services to senior adults. So I have great personal knowledge of how this program works and the impact of it on families and individuals. AARP opposes the proposal in the budget to freeze rates in all long-term care services and facilities for the coming year. Freezing rates will essentially result in fewer staff, and we know that this will adversely impact the level of care a nursing home resident receives. Fewer staff means less care, and this may put many of our most vulnerable citizens in harm's way. I am very concerned about this, what this proposal might do to nursing homes and to the staff that cares for our loved ones. I know from personal experience that quality, consistent care from consistent caregivers is vitally important to the well-being of nursing home residents. We need to pay staff in nursing homes an adequate wage so that workers can stay in these important jobs. People who need the care with daily living want their helpers to be consistent, and they want them to know their likes and dislikes. They want them to be familiar with what time it is best for them to get up, how to wake them up, what their living arrangements mean, and this gives them a much more personal relationship and makes them feel better, and it improves the quality of their lives. Consistent staff is best for everyone, but we cannot keep consistent staff when we do not pay enough and when the state cannot even provide for any kind of raise because of the budget problems. I urge you to make quality care for nursing home residents a priority and to reject the proposal of freezing rates. AARP also opposes the proposal to repeal the new law that seeks to update nursing home rates to meet the cost of quality care to a reform known as rebasing. AARP strongly supports rebasing because we believe that facilities should be rewarded for high-quality care and for the importance directed to hands-on care in nursing homes, and it should be emphasized. It makes common sense to reward facilities for quality care, and I urge you to retain this reform. Nursing homes need more money, and rebasing rates allow for an annual consistent increase in funding for homes. We also strongly urge you, the committee, to reject the proposal to cut home and community-based programs. Programs that help older residents stay in their homes are cost-effective to the state. Reducing the time spent in nursing homes significantly lowers costs for both the government and the individual, and it also creates a better quality of life for those getting the care and seeks better independence for them. We have a strong tradition in Minnesota of ensuring quality care, and we must make sure that it continues. Again, I have experienced the beginning of many, many social service programs in Minnesota, have watched them grow and change throughout the years, and I know you're facing a very tough decision, but our senior citizens and our disabled people are very important to us, and we have a strong tradition that we really need to maintain in Minnesota with providing good care for them. Thank you.
Welcome.
Yes. I want to thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for allowing me this time. My name is Donna Collis, and I'm representing the Seniors for Workers Quality of Care Coalition, and I am the president of Local 9230, which represents a nursing home in Little Falls, Minnesota. I have been an LPN for 34 years and employed at the Lutheran Care Center for the past 19 years. I truly can speak of changes that are in the nursing homes. The residents are not just no longer the sweet grandma and grandpa at the nursing home. They include the alcoholics, the chemical dependents, the bipolar, the manic depressants, the brain injuries, the Alzheimer's with dementia, the homeless who even end up at a nursing home with no place else to go. When I speak of the caregivers, I'm speaking of the LPNs, the CNAs, the kitchen staff, the activities, and the housekeepers who all care for the residents at the nursing home. Currently at a nursing home, we have what we call a revolving door with all new employees. Staff turnover is at a constant rise. Few staff make it through orientation, and those who do may stay a short time and rarely finish their probation. Reasons for leaving are quotes from those employees. You work too hard here. My back hurts. My feet are killing me. Your pay is too low. I can work at Burger King or at Walmart. A lot easier work and a lot more money. Caregivers are already working 12, 16 hours a day, sometimes 2-3 times a week, due to the shortage. Yet the state expects more and more out of our caregivers, especially with the paperwork and less staff. CNAs take care of 10, 12 residents, and often more when working short. Bed alarms, chair alarms, lights go off. All staff attempt very hard to meet these needs. We try to prevent the falls, but it is so difficult at times with the short staff. At the end of the day, your feet and your back hurt, and you don't have a lot of energy left for your family. The residents, they are rushed. They're rushed with cares, they're rushed with treatments, activities, and it's because of the staffing shortage. How is this considered the quality of care or life? The staffing shortage will only skyrocket faster than gas prices with the current budget proposal of no money for nursing homes. Wages were frozen in 2003 and then followed by raises of ranging from 10 cents to a quarter and often did not meet the cost of living. Many nursing homes are already in a financial problem with no money for wages, operating costs to keep up with the inflation. This will only add to the staffing shortage that already exists. Longevity caregivers are starting to leave the field and find other employment. It's called burnout. Our residents, they suffer the most. I ask of you, how unfair is this? Do they not deserve the best of care, the best of quality of life? The state not providing any money for nursing homes, is this a form of neglect by our governor? My mother, she's 81 years old, and she recently said to me, I used to fear when I would get old to go to a nursing home. Now as I get older, I fear that there will not be a nursing home to take care of me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you both for coming down here today. Chairwoman Bisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity today. I'm pleased to have with me two members of our tribal council at White Earth, Irene Aganash and Terrence Tibbetts. This issue is very important to not only White Earth, but to all Indian tribes in Minnesota, and that is the future of our youth who are disproportionately represented in the juvenile correctional system at rates up to 47%, and yet we as Native American people in the state of Minnesota comprise 2% of the state. We at White Earth are ready to offer services for our youth. Most who are in the correctional system because of chemical and alcohol abuse. We are losing our future, and it's not only the future for Indian tribes, it's the future for the state of Minnesota. So I would ask for your continued support for us to secure a treatment facility in Bemidji. Governor Plenty has put $2 million in his budget, and so I respectfully ask for your support for the remaining $4 million in increments. We are just asking that you work through it with us and to help our youth. I say miigwech for giving me this opportunity.
Are there any questions? If not, thank you for being here today and for the other tribal members as well.
Thank you.
Toni Carter and her other commissioners that she's brought with her from various parts of the state. And then this will be the last testimony we take. We are going to have another hearing. If you did not get called on today, we apologize. We're getting a lot more calls than we anticipated, and so we will be scheduling more hearings to take testimony.
Thank you very much. Madam Chairman, I am Toni Carter from Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here to testify today on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I want, first of all, to just offer some brief general perspectives, and then I'll turn to others from Olmsted County to help with additional specifics. First of all, the counties do appreciate that in the governor's budget, there are few direct cuts to counties. We appreciate this because we are still, quite frankly, trying to recover from the many cuts in 2003. And in addition, as I know you are aware, we are currently facing significant reductions from the federal level in Medicaid targeted management, target case management, and other fund sources. Our testimony today, in our testimony, we intend to reflect on how the governor's budget will specifically impact counties, but we also want to encourage you to focus on how the governor's budget impacts our entire system. As counties play a significant role in the provision of a broad array of publicly funded services, we are in a unique position among testifiers also to comment on how funding changes in one program area can cause ripple effects in other areas across the entire system, and ultimately how those changes can impact our ability to serve the citizens and clients that we provide services for. So we would like to focus a part of our testimony on pointing out some of those ripple effects that are system-wide, those that will likely result from the budget that we have seen proposed. As a local elected official, I am really familiar, as you are, with the fact that when we have shortfalls, funding cuts are to be considered, but we also have to be honest and search for what those funding cuts may look like on the other side, as we know that reducing our investments in certain areas can only serve sometimes to increase our future costs for state and local government. So while the strategy in the short term can help us balance the biennium, in the long term it can result in shifts that cause us trouble in future biennium. So balancing the budget this way is not only disingenuous, it is really very harmful to the well-being of clients that we have the responsibility to serve. In addition, publicly funded health and social services programs, as we know, are counter-cyclical. In other words, it is at times like this, when the economy is down, that we need those services more, not less. And in fact, in a recession, as we see people losing jobs and health insurance, there will be more need for these services. Most of the savings in the governor's budget come, as we've heard from many, many others, from the Health Care Access Fund and refinancing TANF to the general fund, and funding transitional Minnesota health care from the Health Access Fund. But depleting these funds is likely to result in higher overall costs for health care and for social services, because we will have more people receiving acute care and also resorting to welfare. So we need to ask ourselves as a society, are we concerned only about the short-term decisions we need to make, or will we consider the long-term impacts as well? Now I'd like to turn this over to Jim Behrens, Director of Adult and Family Services, and Mary Wellick, Director of Public Health in Olmsted County. Mary and Jim will focus on how the governor's budget specifically impacts our county public health and social service departments. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Mary Wellick. I'm the public health director from Olmsted County, and I'm representing the local Public Health Association of Minnesota this morning as well. The recently announced budget shortfall places you as policymakers in a very difficult position. The services provided by state and local government are critical to our community's health, safety, and progress. Local public health statewide has broad responsibilities. They include disease prevention and control, emergency preparedness, assuring access to health care, building healthy communities, and preventing and protecting against environmental hazards. Local health departments are still recovering from the significant impact of the 2003 and 2004 budget cuts. For example, my department continues to rebuild maternal and child health progress that we lost in that time frame and has not been able to reestablish areas of disease surveillance that we had to eliminate at that time. In my county, in the last 5 to 6 years, there's been a collective $1 million shift from the state and federal funds to local property tax. And when you look at Olmsted County as a whole, that's a 23% part of our current budget that used to be paid by state and federal cuts. So in addition to the state impact, we're experiencing federal reductions that are significant for our community. The effectiveness of public health interventions is dependent on sustainability and high-quality collaboration between my department and other departments statewide, the schools, the social services, and other community partners. Without stable funding, our capacity to deliver against the outcomes you expect is diminished significantly, and I think others this morning have referenced that as well. When the economy softens, as the commissioner just said, and when reductions occur in funding and support for community organizations is reduced that serve these high-risk and at-risk people, public health services are in greater demand. For example, the WIC programs statewide have had growing caseloads. In my department, every year for the last 5 to 6 years, we've seen at least an 11% increase. Additively, that's a lot more people who are needing WIC services. Our infrastructure is built on skilled and competent staff and the need for effective and consistent information systems. We rely on your help to retain that resource, and ultimately the result is healthy people, a reduced burden of disease, and safe communities statewide. Counties and the state need to work closely together in determining the ways that we can contain costs and have the least impact on vulnerable and at-risk people. And we hope that we won't be losing the considerable progress that we've made on health outcomes by working with you in determining our direction. I think Jim will add some comments from social services perspective.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the division. My name is Jim Behrens. I work as Director of Adult Services in Olmsted County. I would like to make a few brief comments on the provisions in the budget that are priority for the Minnesota Association of County Social Services Directors and relate that directly to, I think, some effects it has had directly in Olmsted County. First, I'd like to echo the comments made by the commissioner and previous testifiers related to the situation we're in with regard to federal cuts. As we engage the federal government in means to have a lesser impact on those cuts, we ask that there be flexibility in the decisions made in this body with regard to our compliance with the Deficit Reduction Act. Related to the transfer of the $2.5 million from the CD fund, we understand that this is only a balanced transfer, and it is historically done as a way to help with budget in the ensuing years, and it does not have an impact directly on services to clients. However, we have been engaged, the counties have been engaged with the state for several years now to rectify an outdated calculation system for the maintenance of effort expectations by the counties, which requires that some counties pay a larger amount of maintenance of effort than other counties. If we would have been aware of the dollars available, this may have been a means to start to get at that problem. With regard to the proposal that state-operated services withhold federal funds from counties that are over 90 days overdue in their payments to state-operated services, this does seem reasonable on the surface. However, we are in agreement that many of these past due accounts are related to situations that are not in the direct control of counties, those being outdated non-automated billing systems, receiving those bills late from the state of Minnesota, and even challenges of which county is actually financially responsible to pay those bills. If those issues could be resolved, we believe that this proposed penalty is reasonable and fair. We do not support that the counties be required, those counties be required to pay back their DD over spending that we believed was dealt with in the last legislative session. In fact, it's my understanding that those counties each have a letter of forgiveness from the Department of Human Services for those bills. I would want to add to this that I know from Olmsted County's perspective, those budgets are very tightly managed. In our situation, to 0.5% of available resources, so we can maximize the resources for individuals that need those services. Even with that, with the DD waiver budgets, we have 150 individuals that have been screened as eligible for the DD waiver on the waiting list. To further complicate that for these individual counties would have a direct impact on even more recipients of those services. Last, I would want to mention the other home and community-based services and the impact that will have for us. It's our understanding that the proposal is a suggestion to limit the growth of home and community-based services. These waiver programs are a cost-effective alternative to institutional care. And not only if we reduce that growth by 80% in Olmsted County alone, I'm projecting that would be about two individuals each month we wouldn't be able to serve under these waivers that are screened and eligible. As I mentioned, these are cost-effective alternatives to more expensive institutional care, and not only would those individuals' lives, quality of life be compromised, but we would risk adding additional expense. With those comments in mind, I hope that these outline some specifics and how they would affect county-operated, how cuts would affect county-operated programs, and we ask that the legislature and the governor continue to engage counties in these discussions as these decisions are made. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you all for coming. With that, we will be recessed until this evening at 6 p.m.